Existentialism, which is the topic of this lecture, was not known in Britain, apart from a few scholars who studied it abroad, until, I suppose, the late 50s or early 60s. But on the continent of Europe, it had been a philosophy that had been discussed and followed for a good century before that. From the time of the man who is known as the father of modern existentialism, Søren Kierkegaard, a Danish minister, actually, of the Presbyterian Church, but known now as a philosopher, and known as, really, the one who started existentialism in the West in what you might call modern times. And he lived in the first half of the 19th century. He was followed by the greatest of the existentialists, although they weren't called existentialists at that time, as I shall be mentioning in a short while. But the one who is best known, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who lived in the second half of the 19th century, and future lectures will be on each of these great thinkers. In the 20th century, the most famous, or perhaps not the most famous, but certainly the deepest thinker among the existentialists was, the German, Martin Heidegger, who died in 1975. But the one who has given existentialism its name, and more than anybody else has put this philosophy on the philosophical map, is the French philosopher, born in 1905 and died in 1980, Jean-Paul Sartre, who, together with his lifelong partner, Simone de Beauvoir, were really the high priest and high priestess of existentialism, though you will see, I hope, that such titles, apropos of any existentialist, are totally out of place. Not only that, they're inapposite. If you want to read what I consider to be a very eloquent and knowledgeable and comprehensive introduction to existentialism, the book which I think would serve you best is by an American professor of philosophy who died a few years ago, William Barrett. His book is entitled Irrational Man. And he is, I think, one of the most readable of all philosophical writers. He's not only a philosopher, but he's knowledgeable in theology. He's a great theologian. His knowledge of literature is, particularly European literature, and even more particularly Russian literature, is voluminous. And he's also a great expert on art. And in this book, Irrational Man, he indicates how existentialism can be found in these other areas besides in pure philosophical discourse. In fact, he even finds existentialism in the book of Amos in the Old Testament. So that's going back, getting on, I suppose, for three millennia. However, we're not concerned with that. We're concerned today with existentialism as it's become known in the last half century or so. And I want to look at it through the writings of Jean-Paul Sartre, who was a man who did more than just philosophize. He was a very brilliant scholar and a fine writer of novels. In fact, his novels, The Roads to Freedom, are probably as good an introduction to existentialism as you're likely to find, because what he is doing in those novels is creating what we know as existentialist situations, and his philosophy comes through the actual novel. And of course, anybody who can do that, bring out a deep philosophical idea through a very vivid novel, is doing a great service to us all, making it easier, I think, to understand the basic teaching. He was actually offered the Nobel Prize for Literature And is the, but that was for his Rose to Freedom novels, and also for his plays, of which No Exit is probably the most famous one, translated in English, translation of the French "We Clo," the story of three people, two women and one man, who are in a room, and gradually, as the play proceeds, realize that they are going to be in that room together for the whole of eternity, and they can't stand each other. And the famous sentence of Sartre's is made in that play: "Hell is other people." Well, we shall examine that in a moment. But he was offered the Nobel Prize for Literature, but he turned it down on the grounds that he wanted to be known simply as Jean-Paul Sartre, without any title. And I should come on to this point about titles. It's why I said high priest and high priestess would be quite out of place so far as he and his partner are concerned, or indeed any existentialist. He simply said he wanted to be Jean-Paul Sartre. Of course, the irony is that he's now known as Jean-Paul Sartre, the only man in history who turned down a Nobel Prize worth probably about £100,000. So there we are. It's very difficult to escape labels, as we shall see. He was a man of action during the occupation of France by the Germans. He was active in the underground and was almost executed by the SS. It was only the fact that somebody recognized him as the great philosopher that his life was saved. After the war, he was still active in politics. He was active during the what we must call a civil war between France and Algeria during the late 50s and early 60s, when Algeria was in revolt, trying to bring about their own independence rather than being a subject state ruled by France. And he went so far, actually, he was on the side of the rebels, the ones who were wanting independence, and he went so far as to go round French military camps, soldiers about to fight the rebels, and try to persuade them in those camps that they were doing the wrong thing, and trying to persuade them to lay down their arms, which, of course, in time of war is treason. And there were some on the side of the military side in France, fighting for the French, continuing to control Algeria, some who thought that Sartre should be executed, and asked the President de Gaulle what he was going to do about it. And de Gaulle made typical Delphic statement, but one that has lived on: Sartre is also France. So he was not brought and tried with treason. He was at the front of the processions in 1968, which walked through Paris demanding more rights for workers, more independence, more autonomy for them and for students. There were tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of workers and students and left-wing politicians marching, demanding more say in the affairs in which they were involved. And there was Jean-Paul Sartre right at the front, always ready to express himself politically as an expression, I suppose, of his philosophical views. And as I say, he died in 1918. If you go to Paris, you can go to the graveyard, you'll see the grave, a well-kept grave, where Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir lie buried. Well, he made a great impression on France. The French, every Frenchman has heard of Sartre, which is more we can say in this country of any philosopher. I would suspect if you asked 9 out of 10 people in Great Britain to name any philosopher that we've produced over the centuries, that 9 out of 10 wouldn't have the slightest idea. See, at the same time that Sartre was living in France, another very great philosopher, in fact a greater philosopher than Sartre, namely Bertrand Russell, was living in England. Now, when Sartre died, it is estimated that 500,000 people followed his coffin through France. When Russell died, I think there were 7 people attended it. And it just is a difference of attitude between the two countries, how philosophy, and with that, those who express it, namely the philosophers, are esteemed or not, as the case may be. All right, that's the background to Sartre. let's just have a look at what he has to say. His most famous sentence, and it's the sentence from which the name of existentialism originates, and I suspect that you've probably been thinking, well, if this is so down-to-earth a philosophy as it sounds like being, why does it have such another long and somewhat obscure name, existentialism? Sounds like some dreadful disease. Well, it comes from Sartre's statement, existence precedes essence. Now, I'm deliberately pausing at that point to let that sentence sink in. Existence precedes essence. And I can imagine that you're probably thinking, well, what on earth does that mean? Well, let's take the word essence. It's the same as the word nature. And in this case, Sartre is obviously talking about human nature. And in philosophy, there's a lot of discussion as to what is human nature. Is human nature, what should we say, is it naturally altruistic? We looked at this when we were looking at Hobbes and Rousseau. Is it naturally altruistic or is it naturally selfish? Are we thinking of other people's needs naturally or are we naturally thinking of our own needs? Are we body and soul or are we just a body doomed to decay and going out into nothingness? Are we creatures of God? Or are we just part of a biological process which has arrived at us but may well eventually go beyond us? All kinds of answers would be given to that question. But the implication behind the question, what is human nature, is that you can define, in the end, what human nature is. Now, what Sartre, excuse me, this cough of mine, what Sartre is arguing in that sentence is that there is no fixed nature at all. That existence, that is to say, a human being's existence, his coming into existence, precedes it. It happens first. So that only after we've come into existence do we begin to create, and each one of us creates it for him or herself, create our own natures. Each of us, from the moment we're born, follows a different path. Each of us has different experiences. We each have different parents with different attitudes. And these attitudes, obviously, in the earliest years, because they're the only ones we encounter, have a big effect upon us. But then our paths begin to broaden out a bit. And we have other experiences which influence us. We go to school. We meet friends. We become associated with different, perhaps different clubs or different hobbies or different ways of spending our free time. And that brings in other people. We begin to read books. And they give us ideas. And we meet people with ideas and discuss these together. And gradually we begin to formulate certain principles in our own mind or certain values. And we establish in our lives certain priorities, things that we think are very important, things that are all right but not all that important, and things that are unimportant. And thus we begin to shape ourselves. But the point that Sartre is making is that no two of us have the same pattern. No two of us have the same homes. And even if we're members of the same family, because we're different ages, we're going to be treated differently. Parents often say we've treated our children in exactly the same way, but you can't. Once there's one child, your second child is bound to be treated differently from the way you treated the first child. Can't do anything else than that. If the first child didn't have an older brother, an older sibling. Second child does, so your treatment is bound to be different. And then from that point onwards, each goes, there may be parallel paths for a certain extent, but in the end, each individual is making his own way, making his own path through life, creating his own values, creating his own priorities, making, says Sartre, his own or her own nature. Well, now, you may say that's fine, but what about God? Doesn't God have a picture of human nature? Well, we have to accept that as far as Sartre was concerned, this was a non-question because he didn't believe in God. But he did say, even if there were a God, what sort of God is it that makes us all to be shaped into a certain pattern? God has given us free will, and by that very token has allowed us all to follow our own individual paths. So he says, even if there were a God, it would make no difference on this particular issue. He gives the example of this as of a paper knife. I prefer the example of a pipe, and I happen to be holding a pipe. You can't see this, but you can take my word for it. I'm holding a pipe in my hand at this moment, and the fact about this pipe is that it is an object made by a human being. The one I'm holding, I actually saw being made, and I chose the wood, the root from which it was going to be made. And the point is that what it was going to be made of, what it was going to be used for, its size, its shape, its dimensions, everything about it, its nature, that is, its essence, so far as this object is concerned, preceded its existence. Once it had come into being, the idea, if you like, the idea of the pipe was in my mind and in its, the manufacturer's mind, before this actual pipe came into being. Now, as Arthur said, this is what happens with any object. Anything that is made, the person who makes it according either to a plan that is there in front of him or to an idea that he has in his mind. Now, that's the case where you get manufactured objects. But human beings are not manufactured objects, and that is the difference. It is possible, he said, in life to behave as though you are fitting yourself into some sort of pattern and to react in ways that people expect you to react, or even in some cases the way they try to force you to react, try to put you into some kind of straitjacket. It is possible to live like that. That is what he called being en soi, a thing in itself, a thing that just was a thing. And he's rather, well, I was going to say critical, he's almost contemptuous of such people, because he says they allow themselves to become an image in other people's minds. This pipe, the image of the pipe brought about the creation of it and what it was going to be. Some people do allow themselves to a great extent, or to some extent, to be an image in other people's mind, to be être en soi, to be a thing in itself. And his view was that if we are taking seriously this idea that existence precedes essence, and that we are therefore to be in the process of building up our own essence, then we must live a life pour soi, a life for itself, a life which is developing, which is growing, in which we are taking responsibility for ourselves and choosing the path that we will follow, deciding which ways of behavior are right or wrong, establishing for ourselves the priorities that are going to shape the way we make decisions. That all this, he says, is a life pour soi, it's a life in which we are accepting ourselves as autonomous. Now there's a word that springs through existentialism over and over again, autonomous. Two Greek words, autos, one's own, nomos, law, one's own law. Now you could translate that in a way that would sound rather, it'd have a thumbs down approach to it, as somebody being a law unto himself. And in popular usage, such a phrase would indicate a person who was not interested at all about how people, other people behaved, what the law of the land was. He was going to live, do just whatever he felt like, and it didn't matter to him how many people he trod on in the process. Well, that's a rather downgrading of the word. To be a law unto oneself, or to autonomous, as Sartre is describing it, means that you are going to live your life according to the principles, the rules that you have established for yourself, that you have found in your own experience to work, and which therefore means that these are your principles, this is your way, this is the path that you have chosen to follow. He's not saying that we're not, I mean, he's not so stupid as that, is he? Whatever you may say about Sartre, he was not stupid. And he's not saying that we can't avoid being influenced by other people. Of course we're influenced all the time. And people are always giving us advice. My autograph book from when I was a child is full of advice from my aunts and uncles and cousins and all the rest of them. Every page a different bit of advice. Always remember there's a little bit of good in the worst of us, a little bit of bad in the best of us. Good, better, best. Never let it rest till your good is better and your better best. My autograph book is absolutely full of guidelines for life, just like that. And you can't avoid them. But what Sartre, and this is really an existentialist concept right at the heart of it, is saying is that amid all these counsels that are coming our way, we must be the autonomous one. We are the one who is weaving our own path. Now, it may well be that on some of the issues we follow the same path that others have advised. It may be that some bit of a counselling strikes a chord and you say, yeah, that's right. But the point is, you are agreeing and you are following that line, not because you've been told, but because you have found that it has worked for you. If it doesn't work, then you would be equally prepared to reject it. Sartre doesn't say we shouldn't even seek advice sometimes. I mean, most of us, well, we're going to be very lucky if we go through life without some big dilemma facing us where to talk it over with somebody can be very helpful. And Sartre would say, yes, of course we do that, but bear this in mind, that A, it is we who decide who to go to talk over this dilemma. B, it is for us to work through whatever is said to us. Maybe nothing will be said, but if some advice is given, it's up to us to work through it. And above all, see, whether we act on that advice or not is our decision. To take the advice, to listen to someone's advice, and Marcus Aurelius said this in his Meditations back in the second century of our era. He said to listen to somebody else's advice and then to follow it still leaves you free. You're still doing this freely. You could have rejected the advice, he said. So you're not diminishing your own, well, in this case, autonomy, by doing what somebody else suggests. What you have done is listened to all the ideas that are around and then have made your choice. And, well, maybe in some circumstances you do something that nobody has advised, but if you do follow somebody else's advice, in Sartre's way of looking at it, you're still showing your own autonomy. Now, there's another word running through this that I've mentioned two or three times already, and that is freedom. Very important point in existentialism. Kierkegaard, you remember I said, was the father of modern existentialism. Kierkegaard has said, we are free to do, free to be. That's one of the famous existentialist phrases. Free to do, free to be. After all, if we're not free, if, as the determinist philosophy says, whatever I do next is determined, that is to say, fixed by what I've done before, then what is the point of all the debate and deliberation and agonizing that goes sometimes right over the whole issue of making a decision, particularly a moral decision? If we could not have done other than what we did, then much of the agonizing seems, if not all of it, seems superfluous to requirements. And we'll have to look at that more carefully in another lecture on free will. At this point, I just wanted to be quite clear that existentialism is a libertarian philosophy. Now again, there's be careful of that word, because libertarian in popular speech is again one who, usually in sexual behavior, doesn't follow any known pattern of rules whatsoever. He just behaves exactly as he feels like behaving at any given moment, a libertarian. But in philosophy, libertarianism simply means belief in the freedom of the will. And it was a central belief with Sartre. And of course, as you can see, it's absolutely essential to make sense of existentialism. Without freedom of the will, then there can be no existentialism. So, free will is an expression of our autonomy. We are autonomous. We are able to behave as we think right, and we are free to do so. And that is one of the great glories, but it's also one of the great tragedies, or one of the great hardships of existentialism. Because it means that we can never blame anybody else. The other side of the freedom coin is responsibility. You see, if determinism is a much easier philosophy when you think about it. If we are determined, then we can say, if we've done something bad or something wrong, don't blame me, couldn't help it. Kismet, fate, que sera, sera, in that absolutely awful song. Whatever will be, will be. And if it's so the case that I'm going to steal from this shop or attack this old person for her purse, que sera, sera. It makes it very good. And I've heard people in court who stood up and said, well, just look at the background and what else do you expect me to do with all those pressures? Well, that's one way of looking at it, I suppose. The existentialist would say there is no situation in which you're not carrying the can. You carry your own can. Very famous expression of existentialism in the American president who took over from Franklin D. Roosevelt when Roosevelt died in 1944, namely Harry S. Truman. And he had on his desk as president a little plaque, and you probably know what is on that plaque. The buck stops here. Now, okay, he's the president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world. There's nowhere else to pass the buck. But what an existentialist will say is that everybody, metaphorically speaking, should have that plaque, or should have that in mind. That should be his motto. The buck stops here. You carry your own can. And this means that you, it is up to you. It's no good saying, as we do tend to say, why don't they do something about it? I'll bet you've said that many a time. Why don't they do something about it? Meaning the government or the local authorities or the church or the community or the council. Why don't they do something about it? Outside our flat in Battersea, a lot of rubbish had fallen on the pavement, and I heard two or three people say that. Why don't they do something about that rubbish? Well, it's obviously fallen out of a bag, and the thing to do about it was to get another bag and shove it in and wait for the collectors to bring it, to collect it. But it's easy said, isn't it? Let them do something about it. Well, the buck stops here for the existentialist. Of course, there's some people put it even higher than just the council. The scene, you may recall, in the first act of Julius Caesar, where those who are going to be conspirators and are going to assassinate Caesar are discussing together the various terrible things that are happening. Seems that it's not just in our own times that things are going from bad to worse. They always were going from bad to worse, if you read what people say about their times. And these people were grumbling about the conditions. And Brutus says, it's all in the stars. They're very superstitious, these Romans were. It's all in the stars. And Cassius turns on him and gives him, as an answer, what could be the signature tune of existentialism. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. I don't think that an existentialist will have any time whatsoever for astrology. And as for reading your stars in the morning paper, any sound existentialist would treat the whole idea with total, unrelieved contempt, that anybody can take any of that rubbish, even for one second, seriously. The fault lies not in our stars, but in ourselves. And it is bringing us to accept responsibility for ourselves that is one of the keynotes of existentialism. Now,
Sartre says this is not going to be a comfortable philosophy. He doesn't offer comfort. He's a bit like Churchill during the war. You know, all I can offer is blood, toil, tears and sweat. Well, it may not be quite that, but there are three words that Sartre used to describe the existentialist situation, or for any individual existentialist. And the words are anxiety, abandonment and despair. Anxiety because we are responsible for ourselves, that we can't pass the buck, that we are carrying our own can. It is that sense of responsibility that we can never be rid of that brings about anxiety. It's no good just trying to forget that the problems of the time. I've talked to people who say, oh, I never read the papers, they're so gloomy. I never watch news on television. I prefer to think of everybody as being lovely, and these papers just give an alternative impression. Well, I mean, what do you say to such people? They're living in a world that they have created in their own imaginations. It's a world that doesn't exist. And if you're looking at things from the existentialist perspective, then you have to accept that this is how the world is and live accordingly. And it's no good. It's no good you trying to live in your own little cloud cuckoo land. There is the world. Have your eye. You know, your eyes must be opened. There was an American architect who said, and was a bit of a philosopher, who said, we must change our fellow men from being contented animals to suffering gods, conscious of a suffering world. Contented animals. Well, there's plenty of animals who are not content, but an animal that is content is one that would never have to worry about being fed, being looked after. Taken in the warmth during the winter and put out in the fresh air in the summer, looked after, cared for. Whatever the reasons behind it, that's what happens with them. And they don't certainly have to worry about what's going on in the world. That won't do for the existentialist. We must change from being contented animals, pretending that the world is different from what it really is, living in our own mythological world, our own make-believe world. We may be more at ease in that make-believe world, but are we real people if the world we have created is a non-existent world in reality? That's a question for you. Well, that's the first one, the anxiety that comes from knowing. The abandonment is the abandonment that, on this point, Sartre is greatly indebted to Nietzsche. Nietzsche had argued in his one of his books, Thus Spake Zarathustra, that God was dead. It's an issue we will look at when we look at Nietzsche in a later lecture. But the point he's making, but the point that Nietzsche is making, is that God being dead, then all those factors which caused people over the centuries to believe in God must now be seen as no longer possible. By that I mean, people have believed in God because it gives them a sense of purpose in life, gives them a vision of a world beyond, gives them the belief that there's one who can comfort them and counsel them, as the hymn Praise My Soul, the King of Heaven says, guide us, guard us, keep us, feed us, for we have no help but thee. And millions of people have sung those words and have turned to God for that, for comfort in time of sorrow, for strength in time of despair, for counsel in times of doubt, and for, eventually, the assurance of a reward in heaven. Now, Nietzsche said, that has gone. We've now, if we're going to find comfort, we must find comfort any way we can. We cannot, it would be artificial, just as artificial as living in the make-believe world I was talking about a moment ago. to believe that there is a God who can give us comfort. That is deceiving oneself. There is no God to do that. And Sartre takes this up. We are abandoned. It is hard, and many people have been unwilling to accept this philosophy for this very reason. They've argued that human beings are simply not strong enough in themselves to cope with all the dilemmas and demands that life throws at us, that the stresses are far too much, and they will point to the fact that in our own time the mental institutions have never been fuller. People who just cannot face it, cannot cope. Well, existentialism has naught for your comfort, if that is the case. It says either you cope or you live as a thing. You live in this make-believe world. You make an object of yourself. You become an en soi. Because only by accepting the real world and reacting to it and saying, yes, okay, I have to be responsible for what I'm doing, and I will, whatever decisions I make, I will make them with that responsible sense guiding me. It's not a way, I suppose, that can be applied to people who have to live most of the day wondering whether they're going to survive the day in terms of food. And that criticism was put to Sartre. You know, it's all very well for you to say you can be responsible for yourself, that you can live this life of being abandoned. But there are many other people who haven't got your privileges. People who can't earn money by writing articles for papers or writing books or giving lectures. People who wonder how if they're going to survive when they wake up, probably half the world's population. And Sartre accepted that. He wasn't one of these guys who was determined to follow his philosophy and ignore anything that might be suggest that it needs to be looked at in a different light. He was quite prepared to look around, and he accepted that there were millions of people, billions of people in the world, for whom existentialism couldn't possibly apply. But he argued that this was because of the human folly, that okay, there are starving millions, but there's enough food in the world for everybody. And if the community, if the world generally, were to take seriously the needs of the poorest people, those in the what we call the developing world, then there wouldn't be anybody starving. There need not be anybody starving. There need not be. And if we were to take seriously helping people who are ill or facing disease which doesn't give them the strength, let alone the authority, to accept this kind of responsibility for themselves, that could happen. I mean, we read, for example, today of the spread of AIDS in throughout the continent of Africa and South America. Now, okay, there's no cure for AIDS, but to be HIV positive, with certain drugs, the whole disease can be held in abeyance for a reasonably long time, and maybe for longer if we pursue our inquiries. But this is no point saying this to the millions that are dying in Africa and South America, because they can't afford the drugs. The drug companies make sure of that. And Sartre would have said, and on this I'm entirely with him, that the drug companies should hang their heads in shame for keeping these prices so high. People need not be dying so suddenly of this disease. So disease, poverty, starvation are human foibles. They're not part of the natural condition of being in the world. It is because of human greed, the greed of the wealthy West primarily, the profit motive, the desire that a few powerful people should rule the world because of their wealth. And that Sartre took up arms against, and he joined the Communist Party in France for that reason. A lot of people said, how can you, an existentialist, join a party which does have its set of rules, definite principles? I suspect that they were a bit worried about Sartre becoming a member, but his reasons were quite logical. He said, look, it is the only party, and the Communist Party in France was never like the Communist Party in Britain. It was probably more like a left-wing Labour Party. He said, it is the only party that is dedicated to a more even distribution of the earth's goods. It is dedicated to bringing up the status, the lot of the lowest members of society, nearer to those in the middle. And it is part of its declared policy, and I believe in that policy, and therefore I am going to be with them. And although, as I say, he's been strongly criticised for joining the party, one can see the logic in that, though I suspect that he could have done that without being a member of the party. I'm not entirely convinced. But the fact is that he wasn't blinding himself to the world's needs. What he was saying was that these world's needs are brought about not by some divine being, not by some overall invisible law, but by human greed. That's why there is need in the world, human greed. And if he can do something about that, he said, I will. So this abandonment does mean that you've got to be involved in that kind of activity, because it's no good turning to God and asking God to do something about it, because there is no God to do anything about it. That's the point. So that's the second of his words: anxiety, abandonment, and thirdly, despair. And this is linked with it, with what I've just said, the despair of knowing that you are limited by the strength of your own will. Was it Burke who said, evil men prosper when good men do nothing? Because some good men haven't got the strength of will to do anything. They may think that things could be better and things should be done differently, but they haven't got the strength to go out and do it. Sartre had great strength in this respect. He had people listening to him, of course, but he had the fervour, the fire within him. But not everybody does have that, and he recognised that as well. And that he said, this is the unnerving part of the situation, that we can see what needs doing, but we haven't got the will to do it. And there's, if we can't do it, there's nobody else who can. If not me, who? That's the question. And if I can't do it, then I'm just left in despair, because I can see what needs doing and I haven't got the strength of will to do something about it. That is the cause of despair. There is no other power to call on to do anything about it. If we can't, nobody can. Well, now, this is, I think you'll agree, a strong philosophy. There's just, I want to come back to the point I made right at the start when I was saying how Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir would not have taken kindly to being given any sort of title. Part of your walking through life, for most people, is to have a title. People enjoy titles, some people more than most. Like to be called doctor this or minister that, professor this. They love titles, and they wear therefore sort of a label or a badge. And Sartre said, no, we must not hide behind badges. Now, what sort of badges, what sort of labels do we hide behind? We join organisations. Organisations that have definite rules and definite principles that they expound. They have, shall we say, a point of view. And a person who has joined this organisation can very often feel stronger because he or she has got the force of the organisation behind them. Now you may say, what's wrong with that? I'll tell you what's wrong with that. According to the existentialists, it means you're hiding behind a group. Whether you actually agree with what they're saying or not becomes unimportant. It is the group idea, not your personal idea, that is coming through. And therefore, to stand up and say, well, speaking, let's give some examples. Speaking as a Roman Catholic, I'm against whatever. Speaking as a feminist, I'm against something else. Speaking as a socialist, I'm against something else. You go through the whole lot. For Sartre, anybody who began a sentence like that, he was no longer listening to them. wasn't in the slightest degree interested. He would say that if I want to find out what Catholics think about this, or what feminists think about that, or what socialists say about the other, I can find that out just by reading their literature. I don't need to listen to you. It becomes a means of hiding away from reality as it affects each individual. We are not putting our own heads over the parapet. What Sartre would ask is, what do you think, and what has brought you? Could you stand up and defend this point of view off your own bat? Never mind what you've been handed in terms of literature, which outlines the principles of this organization you belong to. Never mind that. Throw that, burn that. Now, what do you think? Throw your label away. Get rid of your badge. Then we'll really find out whether you're living en soi or pour soi. Because to go along with what others are saying is a sign of being en soi, unless you've thought it through. He's not saying people haven't. And I've no doubt there may be some of you who belong to these organizations who will say, well, I didn't begin my life in them, and I read through what they had to say, and it seemed to me to be right, and I wanted to be associated with them. Well, that's one way. But I would suspect that most people in these organizations have sort of suddenly found themselves to be there and have had the ideas thrown at them since their earliest days and have just spouted them as though they were their own ideas. And they may be, but they may not. And therefore, if you're going to spout those ideas, don't say, speaking as so-and-so. Say, speaking as whoever you are. We want to know what your view is and how you've come to see this particular aspect of things. And his big example of this was this idea of wearing a mask. Is his famous example of the waiter in the restaurant, who, whatever he may have been like outside, I don't think he tells us what he was like outside. In fact, he may well have just been making this particular example up, though I suspect he'd watched some waiter at work in one or another of the Parisian restaurants. A waiter who, whatever he was like outside, when he put on his white coat, became all fawning and Uriah Heepish and yes sir, no sir, and not the person wearing this fixed smile which public relations people are told to wear. Obviously, absolutely phony. I'm always very suspicious of anybody with a fixed smile. And so would Sartre have been. He'd have taken the smile off their face in no time at all. Well, this waiter he condemns because he says, there's a man who is not... He's wearing this badge and is thereby, and here we come on to another phrase, and I think it's the last phrase of the existentialist that I should give you. He's guilty of what he called mauvaise foi, bad faith. He's not keeping faith with himself. He's being en soi instead of pour soi. He's pretending to be something other than he really is. He's wearing the waiter's mask. Now, the Latin word for mask is persona. You'll see it in old-fashioned versions of Shakespeare's plays. Personae, that's the plural, dramatis of the play. Persons, literally masks in the play, because in the old days people wore a mask in front of their face on the stage, representing the character that they were playing. Personae. And he's arguing that this is exactly what people do when they are not being faithful to themselves. Now, you may feel that the example of the waiter was not a very good example. After all, a waiter is expected to be polite even if the customers are asking for the reverse. I've always thought that the ideal existentialist waiter is Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. You'd tell him a thing or two, you know. You would have chips, just the sort of thing you would get by. The only hotelier in history, I think, who put a notice on his door which said, no riffraff. That is an existentialist waiter. And one wonders how long. I mean, I can't imagine that Fawlty would ever have survived, though John Cleese always argues that he would. Certainly, if a waiter went around saying what he thought of the customers and being as rude to them as they sometimes were to him, then he wouldn't last very long. And I think a better example, actually, would be a lecturer in a university or college, some of whom are on their professorial platform all the time and are scared to death of being too friendly, too personal with the students, with the fear perhaps that something of their aura would have gone. A lot of lecturers in universities are very glad to have an aura, and they don't want to lose that, and they feel they would if they were too friendly. And they forget that it's possible to have personal relations with between staff and students, between lecturers and students, without having personal relationships. There's a big difference between those two. Some people don't seem to realize it, and they don't even get as far as personal relations. So that the whole situation in there is a professional one and a cold one and an impersonal one. Well, I think that would have been a better example than the waiter, because in my view, a lecturer, a professor, a teacher would lose nothing by being personal with people. That, by the way, he's arguing, therefore, that we have to show faith to what we personally have made ourselves to be. And since we accept responsibility, or should accept responsibility, for the people that we are, then we should not be trying to hide that fact. Now, this raises the question as to how far we can always be exactly what we think to be. Indeed, it raises the question as to who we are anyway. I may think of myself as being such and such a person, though I'm not an introspective type, and I don't very often examine myself in that way. But I suppose I could make some sort of attempt to describe the character I am. Now, how far my description would be the same as anybody else's description of me, it's a very doubtful issue, isn't it? Because people see other people differently. In fact, you could say that when two people meet, there are really six people. There is, first of all, thinking of myself, the self that I see myself to be. There is the self that the other person sees me as being. And there's the self that I am, I really am, unknown to both of us. And the same is true of him. So there's six of us where two people meet. And once you've got three people, you've got a crowd. And by the time you've got four or five people, you're going to fill the Isle of Wight. We are all looking at people through eyes that themselves have created a world and see things in a particular way. It's rather unnerving, but that is the case, that no two people see us the same way. So how far we can always, in every circumstance, express the real me has a lot of philosophical questions and even the practical question. I suspect that all of you would say that in the presence of your parents or your children, you behave and act differently from when you are with your colleagues at work, and differently again from the way you act with friends when you go out for some sporting or musical event, that you are not the same person with them. And it makes you ask how consistent we are anyway, how consistently we are one person at any time. I think, to be fair to Sartre, what one reads about him, and the only time I ever saw him, he was lying under a table in a pub, absolutely dead drunk, so it was a bit of an unfortunate event. He wasn't always dead drunk, but I have a suspicion that his book, incidentally, which I should have mentioned, his book, Lettre et le Néant, Being and Nothingness, gives the impression of often having a lot of it of having been written, at least when he wasn't in his full senses, and certainly it's not an easy book to read. It's too long, needs to be edited, and if you want to get the gist of what Sartre had to say, then the best thing to do is to read his essay. It's only about 80 pages, called Existentialism and Humanism. You can get it. It's rather expensive for its size, but it does give you as clear a picture of existentialism as Sartre saw it as you like to get. Existentialism and Humanism. I think Penguin publish it. And you could do far worse than read that along with the book by Barrett that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. Well, that is a sort of introduction to existentialism, how far you feel it is possible to do this, whether it is as it has been described by some as being a sort of rather adolescent way of looking at things. You know, we're going to change the world, we're going to be true to ourselves, and haven't yet come to terms with the incredible power of social ideas to affect the way we behave, whether it is possible to stand up and be a sort of almost a hero all the time. It has been described as a philosophy for the heroic sort of person. But I'll just finish with this example, and I'll leave you to ponder on it, just to show that it's not always to do with the great world issues, even though Sartre himself was often involved in such issues. Here's a situation which I question whether there is any form, any code of morality that has ever been penned which will give you a clear-cut answer to this question. Here you've got a couple living in a northern town, let us say a couple living in Leeds. He works for an insurance firm, or, well, it doesn't really matter what firm, but a firm in which part of the contract is that he will spend, in order to get promotion, he's got to spend 6 years at head office in London. And that time has come. His wife is a teacher in the local primary school. They have children aged 11 or 10 and about 8. They have two children who are quite happy in their local schools. And the time has come, and the firm has said, now, your next move is to move to London. Do they move? And on what do they base their decision? If he's told that if he doesn't move, then he will be passed over in future. Whenever promotion comes along, he's got to do a spell in head office if he wants to get on in his job. There's a possibility that his wife would get a job in the local school in London. She probably would. Possibility the children would settle in London. They may not. You don't know. On what basis do you make the decision? And I think it's a good example for this reason, that there is no obvious answer. And what's more, the fact that one couple decide to go and another couple faced with a similar question decide to stay, you can't say that one has got it right and what the other has got it wrong. You have, in fact, an existentialist dilemma. And in future lectures that I shall be giving on existentialism, we shall look at a few more of these dilemmas.